We're going to go ahead and get started. And one thing, we will have this as a podcast up on our website, hopefully later on today. And we'll share it with folks outside of this room as well. It's amazing down through the years when the congressman and I have done interviews, we get a lot of feedback from not just inside Oklahoma, but through virtue of some of the other websites that are out there these days, farmpolicy.com and some others. A lot of folks seemingly will pick up on the words. And when the chairman has some things to say, a lot of times that has a lot of impact, especially during this farm bill debate that we've just gone through. So with that said, let's go ahead and get started this morning. It's my pleasure to introduce to you, and I think everybody in this room has a pretty good knowledge of this gentleman, but he's a graduate of Oklahoma State University's Division of Agriculture and Ag Econ grad, a rancher, farmer from Cheyenne, from Roger Mills County. He gets home on a regular basis from Washington, D.C., and Linda always has a to-do list for him. And he's very good about trying to get that to-do list done, because that preserves peace, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
So we're glad to have the Honorable Congressman of the 3rd District of Oklahoma. I think it's changed the number a time or two while you've been in Congress. Was it 6th District when you started? Then it
yes.
went to the 5th District?
6th and then to the 3rd.
Then to the 3rd. Okay, so started as 6th District Congressman. He replaced, we were talking about this a moment ago, he replaced Glenn English, if you remember that name, Congressman English from I believe, Cordell. And then went on, he had a nice little safety net known as the head job for the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association for several years, and then has retired from that position as well. But in an election, I think a special election even, wasn't it? You went in and filled in for Congressman English for a few months, then ran, got that full two-year term, and has been running ever since, has been on the House Ag Committee the entire time. And he's been ranking member, and now the last couple of years has been the full chair of the House Agriculture Committee, one of the most difficult jobs in D.C. because periodically you have to write a farm bill. And it looks like, amazingly enough, you haven't lost too much of your hair, Congressman. And
it's a different color, but
yep. But you're doing pretty well now after the fact. So we're glad to have you here, Congressman Frank Lucas. Give him a round of applause, please.
Thank you. And thank you for that introduction, Ron. And you're exactly right. The 3rd District now used to be the 6th District, but Oklahoma at one time, remember, have 9 congressional districts. So I am the successor to the 8th, the 7th, the 6th, parts of the 4th, and now the 3rd District. But the tradition in the part of the state that I represent is, at least for a half a century plus, the member has sat on the House Agriculture Committee. My predecessor, Mr. English, 19 years on the Ag Committee. Happy Camp before him, 6 years on the Ag Committee. Jerry Smith before that, and Paige Belcher before that for 22 years. He was the ranking member in the late 1960s and 70s, so a strong tradition. In a small state delegation like Oklahoma, we tend to spread out, and with only 5 of us in the United States House, members tend to try to be on committees that reflect their district and reflect the common good of the state. So the Ag District, or the Ag Committee slot, has been held by myself and my predecessors for a good long time. But that's important because agriculture and energy and Main Street business, they're the things that drive the Oklahoma economy. That said, Ron, if we could visit for a moment about the lay of the political land, because after all, good legislation has to be accomplished in a political environment, lay of political land, and then dwell in more to why it took 2.5 years to get a farm bill and what's in the farm bill, and then I know our friends have some insights and observations and questions they'll offer us, which I always appreciate. Why was it so tough? This 2.5-year process of passing a farm bill should have taken 6 months. It shouldn't have had to take 2.5 years to pass a bill to make sure that everybody has enough to eat. And that's what it amounts to, giving producers the ability to raise the food and fiber we need, making sure consumers have access to that both in the United States and outside of the United States. And oh yes, Ron, especially when outside of the United States, they too can pay cash for it. Side note on that element. But it shouldn't have been so hard. And why was it? Well, think about the environment that I've been a part of since we've been in this farm bill writing process. Mr. Peterson, my ranking member, was chairman. He's from Minnesota in 2010 when we had the first farm bill hearing. That November, control of the United States House turned over, and I went from being the ranking member to the chairman. Colin and I reversed roles, but that was just fine. We share a lot of common perspectives. But the environment after the 2010 election and the 2012 election added to the complications. Now think for a moment, several issues, and it all tees together. The makeup of the body, and I will use Roger Mills County definitions. You don't have to agree with those. Just as long as you don't laugh too loud when I use them, I'll be okay with that. But a very conservative House. When the control of the House flipped in 2010, the mantra in the United States House was spend less money, don't do anything destructive, spend more time undoing things. Very conservative body. The president at the time, still president of the United States, President Obama, by the definitions of my neighborhood back home, very liberal. It just is. And the United States Senate in the middle, and I say this respectfully to both our senior United States Senator Jim Inhofe and our soon-to-retire junior United States Senator Tom Coburn, a body whereby the leadership there, which did not change in the 2010 election, is essentially dysfunctional. So a conservative House, a liberal president, a dysfunctional Senate, and on top of that, $16 going on $17 trillion national debt, something the House is very focused on. So as we started to write the Farm Bill, many of you have heard me say before, we didn't have any new money to work with. We didn't have any old money to work with. We had less money to work with. So an environment where we had to craft a Farm Bill that delivered the safety net but spent less doing it and hopefully would do it in a more efficient fashion. And the third element, and don't underestimate this, the third element, the huge turnover of membership in recent elections. When we set about to do our headcount in the summer of 2013, last summer, preparing to bring the comprehensive bill to the floor, counting all the yays and counting all the nays and trying to figure out who would be open-minded and at least consider the merits of a Farm Bill, I was horrified, Ron, to come to the realization that almost half of the United States House, this is last summer, had not been in the House when the previous Farm Bill had been debated, amended, discussed, and passed, and implemented in 2008. So in 5 years' time, we turned over half the membership. And remember, most of my colleagues don't really have a good understanding of what goes on outside the city limits to start with. And this huge turnover of membership. Ask any representative of any farm group, what's the biggest challenge you face both in D.C. and, for that matter, at the state capitol? It's trying to get all these new puppies up to understand, from my perspective on the federal level, there's this thing, Ron, called the Farm Bill. And it's the commodity title, and it's rural development, it's ag research, it's farm credit, it's a nutrition title. It's all of these elements, conservation, all these elements together. So we had no money to work with. A conservative mandate in the House to spend less. We had a whole bunch of members who weren't really sure where their dinner came from, and that's what we launched into. And leadership said to me in the House, Frank, you're going to have an open process. Now, most pieces of legislation when it comes to the floor operate under what they refer to as a closed rule or a modified closed rule. That means with 435 members, you can't let every member offer every amendment they want to offer. You can't let everybody talk about everything they want to talk about because there's not enough time to get your work done. But leadership said to me, we're going to do this Farm Bill in an open rule. The base text that we put together after all of our hearings in committee, where we went through an all-day and half-the-night markup, we considered over 100 amendments. Argued over things, debated on things, voted on things that made sense, and some that were just silly. But 100 amendments. We passed that bill in the summer of 12. I go to leadership and say, I've got a good bill. I passed it by a majority vote of both Republicans and Democrats on the committee. Overwhelmingly. Leadership says, we may not have time to hear your bill this year. Now that's called a Malox moment. When you've done your work, you've been in your field, you've listened to the folks, you've factored in what's going on, you write a bill that saves substantially less money, preserves the core programs, changes the safety net from the old direct payments over to this concept of choice, and we'll talk more about that in a moment, but you don't have time to come to the floor. Don't have time to come to the floor. So ultimately, we wound up passing a one-year extension, And we started all over in 2013 because every 2 years, the term ends and you start over. So once again, an open process in committee, 100 more amendments, another all day and half the night markup. And by the way, the Senate's done their work on both occasions in this time. I'll give them fair credit to that. We get ready to come to the floor. And leadership sets time aside. We come to the floor. But leadership once again says, open process, Frank. I think, Ron, there might have been 140 amendments filed. And we worked through probably half of those with the members before we went to the floor. You know, duplicative amendments, things that basically came from different members that were on the same issue. Consolidated them, focused on a set of votes. And we did a pretty good job. We fought off the naysayers on crop insurance, the people who'd want to whack it. We fought off the people who wanted to put all sorts of funny limitations on how much you could make in ag or in some other business and still participate in the safety net. We fought off all those amendments, really to a pretty amazing degree. But on the last day of floor consideration, this is a multiple-day markup on the floor of the United States House, we had a series of amendments offered by some of my very, very conservative colleagues. Now, remember, I don't put sugar in my iced tea. I'm a conservative guy, too. But we had a series of amendments dealing with the food stamp section that were pretty dramatic and pretty bold. But the House worked its will, and they all carried. But every time they carried one of those amendments, some more of my colleagues on the other side of the room just walked away. And we got down to the last amendment, and quite clearly it was the proverbial straw on the camel's back that was one straw too many. And my ranking member, who was counting votes for me on the Democratic side, Mr. Peterson, as I was counting and working votes on the Republican side, came screaming across to me and said, that's too much. I've had a mass desertion. I don't have the 50 Democrats or 40-some Democrats I think that will vote with us. They're just not going to be with us. And leadership turned to me and said, basically, it's your bill. Do you want to proceed? And I assessed the situation and made a determination that, yes, what had happened probably would make it now impossible to pass the bill. But I had to, what's the polite way of put it, smoke my friends out on the floor. I had to know where my colleagues stood. I had to know where the leadership on the Democrat and Republican side stood. And I said to the floor leader, we're going to vote. And I gave my last five-minute speech explaining what the Farm Bill was for and why it was relevant and why it was so important. The floor gave me a standing ovation, and they voted the bill down, Ron.
Yeah, now it's June.
Yes.
Now, what was
the offensive part about that, Ron, was, though, the members who had voted to make the most dramatic changes in the food stamp program forgot to vote for the bill. If you're going to help me all the way through. Don't just take an axe and take me off. So,
what went through your mind? We've seen a picture of you on the floor after the vote was finished, kind of had the head down a little bit. What was going through your mind?
Well, that's about as public a beating as you can take when 12 million people watch C-SPAN. I actually have, take this with a little bit of humor on, in the Washington Post the day after, one of the reporters had commented on the nature of the floor and the after action, and he'd gone to C-SPAN and he pulled down three pictures. So I have a photo spread in the Washington Post. I know it's kind of surprising, but I have a photo spread. And the picture consists of myself standing in the well, working the members till the hammer was dropped. Then my expression when the thing was defeated. And in the third picture is a line of Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other. You would almost think I was standing in front of a church after a funeral, taking condolences from both sides. And the reporter from the Post, just not generally supportive of ag issues, was fascinated that with the intensity of the debate and the way it had all been handled, the fact that my colleagues on both sides of the room were expressing their condolences to me. Anyway, we split the bill. We passed the nutrition title only. We passed the farm bill title. The Senate passed their version. We went to conference, combined the three back together, ultimately put the final bill together, which then passed on the floor. And I would note to you, as all farm bills pass, at least in my adult lifetime, My friends on the far right didn't vote for it. My friends on the far left didn't vote for it. But a majority of the middle passed the bill. Some would argue, and it's a fair statement, and things could happen before the end of this year, but when this session of Congress closes out at the end of this year, count back 5 years, this will be the only comprehensive bill handled in both chambers in open markup in committee with unlimited amendments offered, the only bill offered on the floor of both chambers with unlimited amendments offered, conferenced out in a public way, and then passed in a recorded vote, not by voice, in both chambers again. I believe, Ron, when I was in school in Crawford, Oklahoma, in the eighth grade, that's the way the civics book said you did bills.
But not too often these days.
Once in 5 years.
Wow.
So that's a miracle. Okay. And the bill's on the books.
This is an agricultural town hall here at the Oklahoma City Farm Show. We're talking with the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Frank Lucas. Let's talk a little bit about a couple of the elements, then we'll get to the audience, Congressman. Let's talk about, first of all, the Federal Farm Safety Net, commodity title number one. It was a true compromise at the end of the day. You really had to almost insist that there were some elements put back in that the Senate did not really want.
Very much so, Ron. The safety net of every farm bill since 1996, the core element was the old direct payment program. Most World Trade Organization, WTO compliant, most difficult thing for the Brazilians or the Australians or anybody else to try and sue us over. But it was politically unsustainable. The national press was after us. Many of my colleagues in the House and Senate were after us. So the direct payments could not be continued into this farm bill. So we had to have a direction to go. Quickly, two different proposals came together. What my friends in corn and bean country in the Midwest, by the way, where my grandfather Lucas was born in 1899 in Indiana. You've heard me say this many times, Ron, but I think you need to remember a part of the country where they measure the soil in feet, not inches, where they pray for rain to plant and they pray for rain to harvest. That's an amazing concept to me, but it does. They wanted ARC, their revenue protection program, which was based on the assumption that you would take 5 years of the previously high prices, and when you had a slight deviation in those prices, that would trigger a payment. I believe it will work well, although I do not expect every producer in the Midwest to sign up for it. But that's what they wanted. And many of the lobbyist groups in that region of the country only wanted that. That won't work for the rest of us. So the House was willing to say, okay, you can have ARC, but we need what we call PLC, price protection. We need to know that if prices get bad enough, there'll truly be a safety net there. We won't fall to earth as we did in the 80s or certain times in the 70s or the 1930s. We won't just collapse. So the big battle was ARC or choice. And in all fairness, we ultimately wound up with choice. Now that means our friends out here, when the law that has been written is fully turned into rules by USDA and DC, and those rules are turned into software, and the software is made available to the state FSA organizations, and their people are trained, they'll begin to sit down with all of us across the table. You'll have some choices to make. Do you want to go with the price protection, PLC? Do you want to go with ARC? Now, some will ask, why do we have to choose? Well, because in the way the numbers worked out, to give you the best of both meant giving you dramatically less of either. So by having a choice, I think most folks will make a good choice, Ron. Your safety net, I guess the polite phrase back east would be more robust. But that's a big part of it. And the focus on crop insurance, and by the way, we protect the crop insurance money. That's the first big choice you're going to have to make. Secretary Vilsack was in front of the committee for 2 hours and 45 minutes yesterday. His goal, clearly, is to begin sign-ups for the livestock disaster programs in 10 days. The goal. I believe they're working hard to get there. I don't know that you could put a pin to the exact time. That's the first issue we'll address.
They still don't have an official announcement that it's going to be April 15th, but they keep saying April 15th.
When the Secretary says April 15th, I believe him to be a person of his word. If it is humanly possible, now we'll see if there are any FSA folks in the audience whose eyes are dilating right now, but if it's humanly possible, it will be done. If not, then then shortly thereafter. But that's the first thing you need to do. And oh, by the way, very important point. In the 2008 Farm Bill, the programs that dealt with livestock disaster, sure, the drought, were not funded in the final year. I was not chairman. I was not ranking member. And a decision was made with only limited dollars in 08 what to prioritize, and crop insurance and crop-related issues were prioritized. Livestock was funded only 4 of the 5 years. And in the one-year extension, we were not funded. The language now in the books fills in that hole from those 2 previous years. So understand, there was more sweat and blood and tears over that than you can possibly imagine. But it was appropriate. And by the way, on my farm, or should I say on Linda's farm that I get to come home to on the weekends, she tells me we're headed right back to 11 and 12 according to her rain gauge, or the first half of 13. So this is important. So be prepared for the livestock sign-up as soon as it becomes available. Begin to think about those choices. But also understand you won't be alone. As soon as I believe the rulemaking process and the rule and the software is done, I think our land-grant friends and a number of our private research friends, think OSU, think Langston, think Noble, think those kind of folks, the Extension Service, they'll be working with us to make those choices, because your choice is for 5 years. It's an important choice.
One single choice. Now, regarding the commodity title, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about crop insurance, and then we'll bring the folks in. But regarding the issue of the commodity title, it seems like we're so late because we're counting the 2014 farm or the 2014 crop year, the crop that we're getting ready to harvest here in Oklahoma of wheat, getting ready to plant in the Midwest for corn and beans. We're going to be almost done totally with that crop and moving toward 15 before we get a chance to sign up for the Farm Bill.
First time, Ron, I pulled my own wheat drill was in 1977. I suspect there's some folks in this audience who put a lot of wheat in the ground for a lot more years than I have. How often have you known what the program was when you put the crop in the ground in September? I don't know that we'll have final rules. But I think in the way the rules that are being crafted, it will address those issues. So let's just give our FSA friends in D.C. a little more time.
Right. Now, crop insurance, already 2 months after the bill is signed into law by the president, we've got some senatorial friends, including a good senator friend of ours from Oklahoma, wanting to basically tweak crop insurance. What about this battle?
First off, when people say that we've spent too much money on crop insurance, first off, remember, crop insurance is like any other insurance now. It's only there when you need it. If you look at the last 10 years, 70% of the policies that have been issued, or 70% of the premiums that cover the policies, generated no return. We had a terrible year in 11 and 12. In corn country, they had a terrible year in 12. That's why we see these payments in recent times. So insurance is there, not because you're going to get something out of every year. You don't. You don't want your house to burn down when you buy property insurance. You don't want your teenager to wipe out your car when you buy car insurance, but you pay the premium. So that's a point. Another point, between the 2008 Farm Bill, once again, I was not chairman or ranking member, between the money they took out of the crop insurance fund then and when the White House renegotiated the administration, I have a better way to put that, renegotiated the reimbursement rates for the crop insurance in 2010, between those two, they took out $17 billion. Crop insurance is given rather heavily already in the process. Now, that said, particular bill. We fought these issues on the floor of the House. We fought these issues in committee. We debated these issues in conference. This is regurgitating an old concept that's already been settled. That's why I call it a 5-year farm bill. Shouldn't have to fight every provision every year. Now, to some of the proponents of this. My father used to say, it's a great thing to be sincere. Sometimes people are sincerely wrong. This bill is sincerely wrong. It is being pushed. The group in the Capitol building that pushes this, stepping away from the members, are what I refer to as the professional environmentalists. They don't like crop insurance because they don't like farming. So if you take away part of the safety net, you discourage farming. Now, why do I say that, Ron? Ask any young farmer, ask any expanding farmer, ask almost any farmer, who cares about crop insurance? And the first response is the banker, then the landlord, then my spouse, and usually the father-in-law. It's something you've got to have. You just got to have it. So my friends are sincerely misguided. We fought this battle, and we fought this battle. We just need to let the Farm Bill move forward.
Of course, this particular bill, $70,000 cap on the premium subsidy that's paid for crop insurance.
You are paying for your safety net when you buy crop insurance. Historically, overwhelmingly, most of the time you'll get nothing back. But think about insurance. What is insurance? It's creating a pool to spread the risk. The more participants, and this is crop insurance, this is fire insurance, this is life insurance, it's any kind of insurance. The bigger the pool, the more you spread the risk, the greater the potential cost to the whole pool when the unfortunate occurs, when you have to make a payout. If you limit by size who could participate, in many instances you're taking out some of the most efficient, best farmers. Now, if this idea of restricting crop insurance to only a limited few were to succeed, you'd collapse the pool. Private insurance companies provide these products. If you take away their ability to make a profit, if you create an exposure to them that is so great, it'll just go away. First time I put wheat in the ground, the most reliable insurance product I had access to was hail. And everybody else just flew by the seat of their britches. I don't want to go back to those days. I get excited about this, Ron, but I'll just simply tell you what an economist from OSU said in a public hearing, a public forum, I guess would be the phrase, 15 years ago. He said, if you want to farm like it's 1957, then forbid the manufacture, sale, or use of any tractor over 75 horsepower. I'm not ready to go back to my 55 Massey Harris that I started with. I hope you aren't either.
Okay. With that, I'm going to go ahead and bring up some of these farm group representatives. Let them visit with you for a couple of minutes each. Guys, if y'all can kind of honor that, then we'll have some time for any questions, any comments from the audience as well. I'm just going to basically start here on the front row, the guys that I've asked, and then work my way back. So, Curtis, I'm going to actually bring you up here first. And Curtis Vapp going to be representing our Oklahoma Wheat Growers Association today. Curtis, your comments for the chairman.
First of all, we'd like to thank Chairman Lucas and his staff for their hard work and dedication in getting this farm bill passed. There are several things about this bill which excite us. It was written by people that are from this part of the country who understand agriculture. Many of them are still directly involved in farming and ranching in Oklahoma and Texas. Because of this, they understand how these programs work in the real world. A couple of facts about this bill and how it helps wheat producers. We're excited about having a program that protects against long-term price declines. We like the ideal of having the ability to increase our level of insurance coverage through a group risk program, which should be more cost-effective, while still being able to have a level of individual coverage. We are very interested about the ability to eliminate total crop failure years from our APH and would like the chairman to tell us more about this option.
Absolutely, Curtis. First, let me note, Curtis is exactly right. When I put a group together to work with, yes, I have a bachelor's degree in agricultural economics, but the kind of detail, the sort of issues that have to be addressed, you've got to have a good team to work with. My staff director, Nicole Scott, is a product of Jefferson County. My senior economist on the group, an OSU guy with a master's degree from Texas A&M, who has basically slowed down, finishes his PhD process to work through the Farm Bill, Bart Fisher, from down in Tillman County. A really, really bright young ag economist. And, of course, on a day-to-day basis, you deal with my ag guy in Oklahoma, Garrett King, one of those Caddo County folks. Now, Ron, you don't suppose our folks north of I-40 have taken note of this. They were just the right people, good folks, and they provide that perspective. And you're entirely right on the issue of dropping the bad years. That's been one of the things in these long-term droughts, is the value of your insurance product just continues to decline and decline and decline until it's of no assistance, but the premiums go the other way. In the language in the bill, working with the department, we make it possible to drop those bad years to prevent that catastrophic circumstance. Now, when we get the final rules and regs, there's some flexibility given to the department, but I think you'll all, especially any of you who have gone through the last 3 or 4 years, you'll be particularly pleased that that is indeed there, Curtis. And he's so right. Bart and my wife debate the price, Fisher debate the price of cattle every time they're together.
All righty. Speaking of cattle, from the Oklahoma Cattlemen's Association, let's get over here out of the direct line of the speaker there so we don't get feedback. Michael Kelsey going to make some comments and a question as well.
Chairman Lucas, thank you so much for being here, and we appreciate your leadership, not only in the Farm Bill, but in agriculture as a whole. And I'm going to ask for forgiveness rather than permission. Normally, I'd ask something about the Farm Bill. That's the setting. About a week and a half ago, though, a federal agency known as EPA issued a proposed rule that really has us as cattlemen, and I know you and in your most recent comments, extremely nervous. We've seen this insidious effort, if you will, by the federal government, specifically EPA, to encroach themselves upon water and through the Clean Water Act to take just almost total jurisdiction of all water. Can you comment on that for us? And let me say, I know in particular because of your recent comments, a lot of what you're going to say, but I want to hear more, and we appreciate your leadership in that effort. Very important issue.
Very important, Michael. And for the benefit of our friends, first let's note the Clean Water Act, passed in 1969, gives the Environmental Protection Agency jurisdiction over waters that are part of the navigable water system of the United States. Now, I'm not an attorney, but my understanding is that some old definition basically defines it as waters that a steamboat can navigate up and down. That takes out a whole bunch of the state of Oklahoma, and it even reduces in the rest of Oklahoma substantially the number. Some of the folks back east would have you believe that there is no regulation, there is no protection for waters once outside the federal government. In Oklahoma, we have a couple of entities that are pretty darned aggressive in fulfilling their responsibilities. The Oklahoma Water Resources Board and the Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ. They do a good job. And from my time in the legislature before I went to Congress and my time as a farmer, I think those two state entities have been very rational in how they've approached their responsibilities. What the EPA is trying to do is, through rulemaking, what Congress won't do, the House won't pass this kind of stuff, is to say that waters that contribute to the navigable waters, the drip off your barn, the drip off your pickup that runs down your driveway, therefore, since it contributes to a navigable water somewhere between here and New Orleans, I should bring you underneath that. And they're doing this by rulemaking. Now, the rule that they put out for public comment worries me and a lot of my friends who've read the language that that's just exactly what it means and that's how it will be interpreted. Now, the Secretary, Mr. Vilsack, was in front of the committee 2 hours and 45 minutes yesterday. And as you would expect, there were a substantial number of questions on this issue. The Secretary tried to assure the body that the way that EPA was explaining their rule, the way the department was going to interpret their rule, there'd be plenty of exceptions for those of us in ag. I would just tell you, in my dealings with my friends at the EPA, they're a different bunch of folks. They don't come typically from a perspective of utilizing resources. they don't come from a perspective of cost-benefit. You know, is the cost of an idea so dramatically greater than the benefit that it's unreasonable? So whether it's the appropriations process or going after the rulemaking itself, which is extremely difficult if you don't have both bodies, we're going to be on this like, as my grandfather used to say, stink on a June bug. Because quite literally, if the worst-case scenario, which is the one that causes me the most concern, is indeed the case, which is every drop of water ultimately in our part of the country gets to New Orleans, then everything we do falls under that jurisdiction. And woe be if you let your dog bowl overflow.
Rod, come on up. We've got the representative from the Oklahoma Farm Bureau. This is our newest member, the Oklahoma Ag Hall of Fame. Rod is the 17th member of the Ag Hall of Fame. Just name a Dasner champion. You're just having a great year so far in 2014. Rod Mozell, of course, from Oklahoma Farm Bureau Board of Directors.
Thank you. Hey, Congressman, I want to thank you very much for all you've done for agriculture. And just like this morning, the great job you do of telling our story. We just wish we could get that story out to more folks. And it was particularly important to have the South represented because those of us that have been following this process, the deck was heavily stacked to the north, and if it hadn't been for you standing there, the southern crops would have been at great peril. My question is, from seeing how long and how hard this process is and the new lay of the land, give us some insight on, there's all these debates about whether in the future this should be separated into two bills, whether it should be a farm commodity bill and a nutrition bill and so forth, and we know how small a part of the Farm Bill now is, the commodity title and the research title and the conservation title, but how do we deal with these circumstances now? And even on the nutrition part, since the action you've taken to try to rein in the food stamp some, we see how states are trying to approach it as economic development and expanding their dollars they're putting in to kind of end run your efforts. So some comments on those areas.
And congratulations on your pretty amazing month, Rod. All good questions. I get a lot of comments in my town meetings. Why do we have to have the social nutrition programs, food stamps, and the Farm Bill with us? Well, understand, remember, that the House is a majority rule body. You have to have 218 of the 35 members to agree to things, to agree to anything, to pass it. So you've got to build a majority of the body to make that happen. All I could say is, if you look back at the historic past, from the first comprehensive Farm Bill in 1933, until the Farm Bills of the early 1960s, they passed strictly on the merits of the commodity title, the conservation programs, you know, ag research, rural development, the farm credit. They passed on the merits of what you and I would refer to as a Farm Bill programs. But in the 1960s, it appears that my predecessors began to realize that as suburban America was growing, that between that group and inner city America, we were suddenly becoming the tail on the dog in rural America. Would they always be able to pass farm bills? And the decision was made when I was a little boy, after then-President Kennedy started the pilot project that would become food stamps, that Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, incorporated in his bill. My predecessors on the Ag Committee back in the 1960s, I concluded that reaching out and taking this new program that was important to inner-city America would help forge a coalition, make sure you can raise the food, make sure people can eat, that would continue to drive a majority and pass farm bills. And that's the decision that was made before my day. And that worked pretty well until we got into the 1990s. And at that point, that band between inner city and rural America continued to expand and expand and expand, and it became more and more difficult to pass farm bills. In 2002, my second farm bill, when I chaired the subcommittee on conservation, rural development, ag research, I made a very big point, with the then Chairman Combest's support, of driving new resources into the conservation program and spending a huge amount of time in committee and on the floor explaining to my colleagues, well, you may not care about where somebody in the center of town gets their food, and you may not care about how we raise the food, but oh my, you do like chasing those birds, don't you? You do like chasing those fish, don't you? You do like taking pictures of nature. And we went from a two-legged stool to a three-legged stool. Well, now in the environment of the last 3.5 years, this argument has come back up about split the pieces and parts off. The same crowd that wants to make crop insurance more restrictive, the same crowd that wants to make crop insurance less accessible, now wants to split the farm bill back up in pieces. I don't know that you could pass a farm bill all the way through conference and to the president's desk for a signature and get it done anymore. So this coalition has to be there. The difference in this farm bill and previous farm bills, when we knew we had to spend less money, $23 billion less dollars overall, compared the next five to the previous five, I said, and the committee backed me up, we make cuts everywhere. We reduce spending in the commodity title. We reduce spending in the conservation title. And oh yes, we reach out and grab that electric fence wire back east called nutrition. And we have reform everywhere. But that's necessary. The nutrition reforms. Very difficult when your counterpart is the chairwoman of the Senate Ag Committee and a United States Senator from Michigan to make a lot of big, bold reforms. Remember Detroit, the Rust Belt, the unemployment rate three times higher most of the last 10 years than the rest of the country. We persuaded the Senate to agree that there should be no more advertising of food stamps. We persuaded the Senate to agree in language there shouldn't be any more recruiting. We persuaded the Senate that people who are legally here shouldn't receive food stamps. We persuaded the Senate that we should compel USDA to work harder to create a system with the states so that dead people don't get food stamps. That people don't get food stamps in two or three states. Things like that. And we also persuaded the Senate to agree that something called LIHEAP, or Heat and Eat, which is, I define, a loophole from the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, where a state can send a citizen of theirs a $1 check under the old law to heat their house. I suspect in certain northeastern states that somewhere around between a pint and a cup of home heating oil, that triggers an automatic food stamp benefit for the month. Around $300 in some places. So a state spends a dollar of their money, and they get $300 out of the treasury. You can call it gaming the system. You can call it mining the U.S. Treasury. It's manipulating the system. So we got the Senate to agree at least to take that from a dollar to 20, projected to save $8 billion. I mean, we're talking about real money in these programs, $8 billion. Well, now a number of states have announced that if $1 out of their pocket and getting $300 back in their state was a good investment, they'll just spend $20. What will happen is that this now will become an issue in the agricultural appropriations bill this year and next year. And when you have a different president, whoever he or she might be in January of 2017, I suspect you'll see a legislation to end the whole program. But some of our friends back east, some of our governors, are shameless in saying if they can take a little bit of their money, they can reach in and take a whole lot of taxpayers' money. That's what infuriates people about these programs. And oh, by the way, I understand at least in one of those states, to pay the 20 instead of the 1, they're taking money out of their emergency heating fund. So you're taking people who've had a catastrophe or disaster who can't pay their heating bill, and you're taking that reserve fund away to fund this income transfer scheme. Short answer, Ron, or short answer, Rod. I don't think you can split the farm bill, but I think you can reform all sections and you can get the balance back to where it should be. And oh, by the way, one other thing. If you get the economy growing and you put people to work, there's less applications for those food stamps.
Trey, come on up. Got a couple more folks, and then we'll take any questions from the audience. Quick commercial, though, first of all, a thank you this morning to State Fair Park and also to the Oklahoma City Farm Show. John Riles, right over here. Wave your hand, John. John is with Midwest Farm Shows. They've put on the Southern Plains Farm Show for the last several years. Now it's the Oklahoma City Farm Show. We thank them for working with us to secure this building, to have this facility, to be able to do this Ag Town Hall today. Let's give John a round of applause. Trey, representing Oklahoma Association of Conservation Districts, has a question.
I want to express our appreciation for what you did, and I don't believe personally that the Farm Bill would have been passed without your leadership. I think your statesmanship and your ability to endure what you were put through and come out of it and continue to govern. There aren't a lot of people in Washington that want to govern these days and want to be leaders, and we really appreciate your leadership. And we know that conservation wouldn't have been represented in this Farm Bill if it hadn't been for you. And we thought if you could spend a few moments talking about the conservation title and specifically about Oklahoma and how it pertains to us and the small watershed program, and maybe have you finish up with a few comments on the lesser prairie chicken and the work. We've done a lot of work to try to keep that from being listed, but if our landowners and operators would be rewarded for that. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Conservation, like the other sections of the bill, had to achieve savings. The lion's share of the savings came out of the reductions in the acreage in CRP, Conservation Reserve Program. A very, very politically popular program and utilized by a whole bunch of my folks in the 3rd District and across the great state of Oklahoma. We also consolidated a number of conservation programs, trying to maintain the core missions, but reducing the number, trying to reduce the number of different forms of administration efforts required in that. I would tell you that a big part of why CRP came down, and I've spent a lot of time with my quail and pheasant and duck friends discussing why instead of 32 million acres of CRP in the old Farm Bill authorized, we're going to have 25 this time. There's a short answer. It's called ethanol. The renewable fuel standard, the drought, a demand for additional grain production. Remember, CRP is a 10-year voluntary program. By the way, Ron, voluntary and incentive base are still two key phrases in all conservation programs. Voluntary, incentive based. I work with a lot of people who don't want to go that route. They want to tell you what you should do, and that's wrong. And we'll talk about prairie chickens in a moment. So the CRP acres come down, reflecting the demand for additional grain, the number of acres coming out of CRP and going back into planting. In the other programs, we really did an amazing job of protecting EQIP, that basic cost share program for both livestock people and row crop folks. And that's dramatically greater than it was when I was first the Farm Bill before the 2002 one. So utilize those programs as much as you can. In the upstream flood control rehab program, you know we in Oklahoma understand this as well as anybody because a lot of our predecessors in the conservation movement, my predecessors in Congress, were critical in the 40s and 50s in getting the pilot projects and the initial programs up. And after I became a member of Congress, we started to approach that 50th anniversary date of those first structures, which, by the way, were only designed for 50 years and designed in a time before we really understood the importance of upstream sediment control, which we now do, in all fairness. We crafted the bill almost 15 years ago plus, I guess now, to create the rehab program, a cost share program. But I'd had a great deal of difficulty protecting the money from year to year from my appropriation friends who tended to want to reallocate it. In this particular Farm Bill, because of the timing of the bill becoming law in a year when the appropriations process was completed, the new appropriation year starts on October 1, there's about $250 million in that account for rehab. I will tell you what I tell every conservation activist across North America who has a structure that's 50 years old or 45 years older. Get it encumbered. Get your maps done. Get your planning done. Get it encumbered. Get it locked down before October 1. We'll never have this much protected resource to work that fundamental program. Now, in Oklahoma, we've done an outstanding job of being prepared. A lot of states had the attitude of, well, it's always been X dollars and there'll never be any more dollars, and why get in a hurry and why worry about it? Your conservation friends at the district level, at the state commission level, have done a good job of doing their homework. And don't forget, my friends, in this drought-stricken period of time, many of those same basic upstream flood control structures our municipal water sources too, and the importance of rehabbing those in particular. My post office, my church, where I went to high school, Cheyenne's water source is an upstream flood control dam. Utilizing those resources is critically important. So I would tell you, I think we will have a better job of protecting the money in the future. But I'll go one step farther and say, while rehab, as we put it together 15 years ago, has a priority establishment system based on the needs, the new flood control structures, and there's still hundreds and hundreds right across the country that have never been built, that everything's ready to go, that's a haphazard program that depends on the appropriators. My goal before this year comes to an end is work on putting a bill together to create an orderly program for new construction. It was too heavy a lift to do in the Farm Bill. That's my goal, is to try to come up with a way to, in the fashion we rehab dams, to build new ones. These upstream flood control dams are one of the most miraculous things, state, federal, local cost share, just the most wondrous things. Prairie chicken. I live in Roger Mills County. And when Ron sends us out all across the world, I'll get in trouble. I've never seen one. But I have read the accounts about how, for instance, you're supposed to cross fence to give them better habitat, but then you've got to put little tapes on there because one of the leading ways of death is they break their necks flying into fences. This must be an amazing bird. An amazing bird. The Oklahoma delegation, my friends in Kansas, the Texas Panhandle, West Texas, New Mexico, Colorado. We spent a lot of time with the Fish and Wildlife folks trying to help them understand the situation. Now we don't have an endangered listing, but we're the next level down. We're going to stay on the forefront on this, but if you care about ag, if you care about the oil and gas industry, I don't care whether it's an electric windmill or your water pump windmill, if you care about that, this is serious business. I have watched in the last 20 years how these kind of issues have just turned other western states into knots. We don't want that to happen to us. But along with the navigable water issue, it is probably the single most dangerous thing now facing those of us in rural Oklahoma, those two issues. And I'm not sure if it wouldn't rain, it wouldn't address all the wildlife issues.
Okay. Kerry, come on up. President of the American Farmers and Ranchers, Terry Dietrich. I think you know Mr. Dietrich. Terry?
Congressman, we go a long ways back. I was thinking this morning, I think I was there all the time that you've been in Washington, D.C. I've been to see you, but then it dawned on me this morning, I was on Glenn English's panel when we originated crop insurance. And my article, or my point at that point was, it's relatively simple to work on, so to speak. We know what our needs are in crop insurance, but we were totally excluding our cattlemen at that point. And it's taken us a long, long time. We've got 28 or 29 years of evolving the crop insurance to work out a lot of bugs. We're best at finding loopholes. Nobody's better than a farmer and a rancher to find a loophole somewhere, but we're closing those. But folks, you've gotten a little bit of an idea here on all of the broad range of stuff that Frank has to agree with or be acquainted with. I was in your office just almost immediately after you were appointed chair. And I told you then I did not envy you because you had the budget against you, you had public perception against you, and you had leadership in the House of your own party that had never supported farm
laws. You actually did make all those points. Yes, you did.
I did. And they all proved to be big hurdles for you to cross. The one thing that I would like for you to address before I make some remarks that you're too humble to make is about the imports of beef from foot and mouth disease countries where it's known to be there. We've got people who want to primarily packers, I think, who want to import it into this country, and also the biosecurity research station that's supposedly on plans to go into Kansas that is right in the middle of cattle country. But folks, I just want to say, everybody else, and they've done a great job covering these issues and asking the questions. This guy has been a statesman. He has done Oklahoma proud. I watched him on C-SPAN, and that night before, I thought, boy, this thing is the skids are greased, and it's going through the next morning.
I tried hard.
Only to see one of your leadership, and I'm not critical. There is no innocent political party in Washington, D.C. today. There's not one of them that's innocent. And the biggest problem is there's too many of them making politics instead of policy. And, Congressman, you made policy. And I want to thank you for concentrating on that. And that was your philosophy all the way through, to make policy. And even right down at the last minute, you were under a lot of pressure for this bill to be defeated after all we had done for cattlemen, for crop insurance, for everything else. There were some single interests wanted to defeat the whole thing because they didn't get their one thing through, and I know you had to withstand an awful lot of pressure there. But I appreciate your understanding of insurance. It slays me when, and I'm not too bashful, I'm disappointed Senator Coburn wants to come in and mess up the insurance. He says it'll only affect 1.3% of the people. However, we haven't seen the percentage on how many acres, and it's acres that we've got to have in order for the rest of us to be able to afford crop insurance. We've got to have a lot of acres, and some of those that's excluded, would be excluded there, are some of the most proficient and the best producers that keep the rates from being what they could be without them. But his understanding of the fact that the best cure for high prices is high prices, there will be low prices. Yes. You know, all I heard in Washington, D.C. from other people that don't understand you and I was that, farmers are making more money than they've ever made. Well, they haven't been to Oklahoma. They haven't been to western Oklahoma. They haven't been to southwest Oklahoma. They haven't been out here in cattle country where guys have liquidated their herds and don't have any income with high-priced cattle. But anyway, I just want to thank you for being a statesman. This guy, even the night before, his time, and when they debate, they yield their time if they have some left over. Representative Peterson, ranking member on the Democrat side, had used up all of his time. Frank had a little bit of time left. Frank knew that where he was going to come from probably was not necessarily the same route he was going to come from, but he yielded the rest of his time to Colin Peterson to be able to say what he had to say so they could have open debate. And all of this open process you were talking about, behind all of that was a hidden agenda. So thank you. I think we owe him a standing ovation, not just a round of applause.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you very much. First, let me say there are a number of things still yet to be done by the Ag Committee. I believe there's a high probability that next week we'll take up a bill to reauthorize the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Those are the folks with the jurisdiction over derivatives and the futures and hedging and all that sort of stuff. I think we have a bipartisan bill worked out that a majority of both sides of the committee will support. There will be hearings on GIPSA and COOL and all those issues that were so discussed in the Farm Bill. That's coming. You've heard me say earlier my focus on trying to create a new upstream flood control dam construction bill that will prioritize and rationalize that effort. But let me also say, and I know we're winding down, Ron, but let me also say, you have to understand the perspective that I come from. There's a tendency in Congress to go to D.C., and never come home. A tendency to take your kids and raise them there and all that sort of stuff. I've told all of you who I've known well for any length of time that part of why I go about the way I do my things is the context and the history of the people I was raised with. All four of my grandparents were young people during the Great Depression and the drought of the 30s. They were scarred by those experiences till the day they died. My grandparents, all four of them, to the day they died, were convinced the Depression was coming back tomorrow. That's why those sellers had all those cans and fruit jars, remember, that were empty. They were sure it was coming back. My parents were young men and women in the drought of the 50s, which in my part of the state was a 53 to 57 horrendous experience. That's the second time you watch the census numbers drop. You don't rain and you farm, you don't eat, you got to go. I came back from college in 82. You remember the bust, the Penn Square ag and energy collapse that rippled for the next 15 years through land prices? I just got home a little too late to get underneath the wave. But I watched what my neighbors went through. Saddest thing I've ever done is to go to a neighbor's, or I should say the sheriff's sale, selling one of my neighbors out. That's the saddest thing you can go to. That particular guy was a Vietnam War vet. He came home from the Army to farm. And it wasn't just, it was across the country. So my policy perspective has been a combination of two things. One, all we can do with insurance is to try and tone down a little bit of what Mother Nature decides. I can't make it rain. You got to talk to the Senate, Ron, if you want that. I can't make it rain, but I can address that. But I can make darn sure that federal policies don't create catastrophes like the 30s, which federal policy did contribute to. Don't create catastrophes like the 1980s that federal policy contributed to. And I can do it in a way that when my neighbors decide I need to come home, or Linda Lucas, whichever comes first, I can walk up and down the streets. My ranking member tells a story about a certain Secretary of Ag from his state who was secretary during a really, really tough period in the late 70s and early 80s, and some of you will guess the name. He'd been a House member for a long time, good guy, but he was the wrong place at the wrong time. And Colin said it took 10 years before Bob could cool off enough to come home to Minnesota. I don't want to have to live in Canadian Texas for 10 years before I can come back into Oklahoma. And that's how I've tried to conduct myself. Again, my friends, thank you for all the input and all the help you've provided through this Farm Bill process. And every time I've spoken to Ron or any of my other Oklahoma media friends, for 2.5 years it's been a national press conference. I've tried on a couple occasions to explain to people, when you ask that question, whatever goes in these microphones is going to pop out in the most amazing places because you're being tracked. My media friends are. But that's okay. Again, thank you, and thank you, Ron.
Couple of questions from the audience, or you got time? You need to move on. Okay. If I got a couple of questions from the audience, we can take those, and then we'll need to go ahead and release the chairman this morning.
You mean get back to Linda Lucas's assignments?
Okay, yeah. He's headed down to a Shorthorn show. So, quick question, sir.
Yeah, Congressman, we do appreciate everything you do. I was talking about the prairie chicken, how it's going to affect the industry, oil and gas industry, the electric industry, rural co-ops and stuff, is a traumatic impact. Part of the deadline was just passed here, new regulations that they're going to have to go under. How do you see that playing out? Because that affects each and every one of us in some way or another.
You have to go back just a little bit to when the EPA first took notice of the issue. In Oklahoma and the adjoining states, our state entities reached out to the various industry groups, ag, energy, electric transmission, all those things, and tried to come up with, what's the polite term they use, Jimmy? Remitigation plans to try and remitigate the problem, to try to address it so that we wouldn't get a listing of any kind. The delegations from the four states, as I mentioned to you, worked hard on that. But we are where we are. Ultimately, when it all comes together and we go through the public comment period, understand that under the Clean Water Act on water issues, if that rule becomes ultimately final law and is interpreted the way it could be, or the Endangered Species Act on things like the prairie chicken, that bird, for instance, comes ahead of property owners. that bird takes under federal law, and this was passed long before I ever got there, and I voted for more bills to, quote, reform it than you can imagine, that never made it all the way through. But that bird becomes the most important thing on your ranch or on your farm. And you cannot, in the worst-case scenario, do anything that the EPA defines as contrary to that bird's interest. Now think about that. Doesn't matter if you've owned the place 50 years or if your family's been there since 1892. Suddenly, the bird, or the potential of the bird being there, becomes the most important living creature on your farm, your ranch. And how you farm and how much cover you provide can be, in the worst case scenario, an issue. Or if somebody wants to build a location for an oil and gas pad, Lord have mercy, gravel a road because of the dust factor it puts in, or the changing in the fencing. Do not underestimate how important this is to all of you. Same could be said about the water. If the EPA controls every drop that falls off your house, your barn, or the brim of your hat, they give you the ability to say when and what and how much. These are frightening things. I personally would like to believe that when these statutes are really originally passed in the 60s and 70s, Congress did not intend to empower bureaucrats with that much power. But part of the problem is, over time, you've had very aggressive people who have been put in the roles of administering the rules, and you have outside groups that have developed this wonderful system of going to court to sue over these issues. It's not an accident that they happen to go to certain courthouses and in front of certain judges. That was politely worded, wasn't it, Ron? But the cottage industry is that when they sue, not only do they force an action from the agency, but they get reimbursed from the U.S. Treasury for their legal billable hours. My late father would have called that a meal ticket. So you've got all these things working together. There are instances and there are committees in a jurisdiction chasing this issue where it almost appears, and I'm not referring to these two particular circumstances, but in situations where it almost appears that agencies are saying, oh, don't sue us. Don't sue us. Don't file this particular suit. Because then a judge tells the agency what the bureaucrat wants to hear to begin with. That's trying to be a little bit polite, Jimmy, but I think our friends understand where we're coming from, right? This is scary as all get out.
Congressman, thank you so much for your time today. It's great to have an opportunity. You talk about you a lot of town hall meetings around your district, but it's nice to have one focused on the world of agriculture, rural issues. I know our folks that have gathered today do appreciate that.
Thank you, Ron.